Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt on this Wednesday, August 6th.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg.
All right, Kevin, let's do a little rewind to start the show today.
Sure.
On this day, 1787, delegates here in Philadelphia begin to debate the first draft of the U.S. Constitution.
Okay.
Now, that Constitution lays out Congress, what it should look like, the whole census thing. They foresaw the need to put that in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Did not foresee the need to tell states exactly how to draw congressional district lines. That brings us up to the present. States have a lot of power over how to do that. And in Texas, Republicans are trying to redraw maps well after the census.
Right.
To get five more seats potentially for the Republicans in the midterm elections in 2026 and potentially hold on to power in Congress because of that. That has set off a whole wave of threats from Democratic governors. They say they'll do the same in their states. It's a mess. It's an arms race. We're going to talk about it today on the show.
Redistricting arms race and this interesting thing that's happening in Texas where maybe for a decade plus we've heard all these kind of good government ideas of reform, what the redistricting process should be. Let's move away from gerrymandering. And this is a bald, hey, no, let's gerrymander. Let's do it. Let's do it for political reasons.
Throw all of that out the window and just win, baby, to quote Al Davis. So our question for you today, before we get to that conversation, and would love for you to hop on the phone now, should political leaders abandon good government reforms and go all in on gerrymandering? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org with your thoughts. If you're on YouTube, hello, drop a comment in the chat. Again, should political leaders abandon good government reforms and go all in on gerrymandering? All right, before we get to all that, Kevin,
yeah.
Trio of local news stories. Start us off.
Story number one, SEPTA. The clock is ticking on major cuts to service and fare hikes. The agency said today if it doesn't get a boost in state funding by next Thursday, August 14th, service cuts will go into effect on the 24th, and fares would increase by about 20% on September 1st. Here is SEPTA General Manager Scott Sauer at a press conference this morning.
We want to preserve service as much as possible. The issue now becomes timing, the timing of a resolution and then the amount of whatever the funding is determined to be. We'll determine how much or how quickly we can put the service back.
So what exactly are we talking about here, Avi? 32 bus routes that would be eliminated, 16 others shortened, along with reductions in the frequency of buses, trolleys, subways, regional rail. Midday frequency on regional rail drops to 2 hours of a wait between trains.
Wow, 2 hours between every train.
Between trains in the midday. And the context here, of course, is most of SEPTA's money comes from state government. State government has been skeptical of providing more money. It already gives SEPTA $1 billion. SEPTA has this $200 million plus shortfall in its budget. It's saying we need more money from the state. Governor Josh Shapiro and the Democrats in the State House are saying we have a plan to do that. Republicans in the State Senate are saying we're skeptical, and they cite things including fare evasion in recent years as a marker that SEPTA has been mismanaged and shouldn't get more state funding.
Yeah, and the state budget is more than a month overdue at this point. So SEPTA's been waiting and waiting and waiting, and now they're saying, look, the cuts won't start until late August, but if we don't get the money by next week, we have got to move forward with the logistics for the cuts. SEPTA is not a speedboat. You can't just turn it around in one day. You've got to do all sorts of planning with labor, with infrastructure. You've got to tell, like, Google Maps, for instance, what the schedules are. So when people punch that into Google Maps, they get accurate information. There's a lot to do. And so understandably, they're saying, look, yes, that's when the cuts will start, but we've got to implement them starting next week if we don't get more money. Story number two, Kevin. The GOP has not won any big elections in New Jersey recently, but Republicans there are feeling a sense of momentum after keeping the last governor's race pretty darn close and losing by only 5 points in the latest presidential contest. And there's some new voter registration data out of the Garden State that puts some numbers behind that optimism. So this story today is from the New Jersey Monitor. It found the Democrats hold a roughly 865,000 voter edge in the state. That's down from 1.1 million in 2021. So 4 years, big drop in that Democratic edge and some big GOP gains. And all of this comes with a big gubernatorial election ahead in November. And that's when that Republicans feel like they've really got a shot in, with Jack Cittarelli running for the third time with quite a bit of name recognition.
So interesting hook there in New Jersey, and we've seen the same kind of slippage for the Democrats in Pennsylvania. Really, actually astounding numbers if you look back.
Yeah, Pennsylvania is even more astounding.
Democrats in voter registration, right, which doesn't always equal how people vote, but at least in voter registration, had about a million vote advantage, million registrants advantage about a decade ago, and now it's down to 60,000.
Incredible. So it's basically
you've seen 50-50. Such a change in a decade.
Yeah, and so I was reading an analysis, and I'll shout out Nick Field, who does some good numbers crunching. He's a political observer. And one thing he noticed when you look at that last 10 years in Pennsylvania is that the number of registered Democrats has fallen, but not by that much. It went from like 3.9 million in PA to 3.8 million. What's really changed is that a lot of people who were not registered, were on the sidelines, have come into the game as Republicans in Pennsylvania. And you have to say that's the Trump effect. People who were disengaged from the process, registering as Republicans in Pennsylvania. Of course, it's confusing, right? Because over those 10 years, Democrats have had some huge wins in Pennsylvania. Right. They won the 2020 presidential. They've held the governor's mansion for three straight elections now. They've taken control of the state house. So like you said, registration is not destiny in terms of who wins. But of course, it's still incredibly notable.
But to your point, the Trump effect is huge there, right?
Huge.
Because if those people who were on the sidelines before are registering as Republicans, it seems to really come out for Trump when he's at the top of the ballot. But they don't seem to be coming out in the same way for Doug Mastriano, for instance.
Right. Off-year elections.
Governor. Yeah.
Yeah. Or even just down the ballot elections. And that's something that the GOP has to contend with moving forward in Pennsylvania, potentially. All right. Story number three. We're mixing it up a little bit here, Kevin. What's going on?
Well, consider this the soft rollout of a new segment called Arbitrator Avi.
Ooh, I like that. I feel wise already. Wow.
I need a ruling from you on the situation I found myself in last night. So I went to the Wilco show at the Met with my wife and a couple of our best friends.
Okay.
We don't get to see them all the time, so it was like a big deal for us.
Okay.
And our seats are in the upper level near the balcony. Now, 99% of the people in this section are sitting, except there's one couple a few rows ahead of us who has decided to stand. And this starts causing all sorts of consternation for the people behind them.
Of course.
People are starting to yell at them.
They can't see Jeff Tweedy.
They can't see Tweedy. If you were there to see the Wilco bassist,
yeah,
you could see the Wilco bassist pretty well, but you couldn't see Tweedy.
You got to see Tweedy. You're there for Tweedy.
The vibe is starting to get off, right? People are angry. Now they're not focusing on the music. They're thinking about this couple, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, to the couple's defense,
It
looked like the entire bottom floor of the venue was standing. Okay.
The people in the lower bowl were standing.
And maybe these people just love Wilco so much that they can't stand it to sit still while the dad rock vibes are flowing.
Hard to relate to, but possible, yes.
So the Arbitrator Avi, who's in the wrong here? The people who wouldn't sit down or the people who were mad who could have stood up?
Well, first I'd like to say a couple white guys discussing a Wilco concert. This is groundbreaking stuff. So thank you for bringing up this really important topic. I need a little bit more information. So the whole venue is seated, right? Including the first level.
Yeah, I mean, at the very front near the stage, I think there's a pit where that's standing only.
Yeah. But people were standing
in their seats
in the seated
them.
Area on the front level. I don't even get that. Why are they doing that? What is? I mean, you're at a Wilco concert, right? Isn't the whole point to sort of stare at the ceiling and ponder the infinite?
Yeah, I mean, you can bop
it's not
a little
dance
bit.
Music.
You can bop a little bit. There's some bops.
So I come at this from this perspective of who's playing. I don't think Wilco is super dancey. So I would think that the standard would be to sit down. I don't go to a lot of concerts, disclaimer, but I would think the standard would be to sit down, especially so on the second level.
Yeah.
I think if everyone else is seated and you two are the only people standing, you've got to take the cue. You've got to go with the group. The social contract has spoken, right? You must sit.
Okay, so if it's a George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, everybody's standing in it.
Totally different vibe, totally different etiquette. It's Wilco. It's sort of jingly jangly, right?
Of course.
So people were dancing to it?
People were, they were kind of swaying. So then
you could sway in your seat.
Here's
you
the
could
other
definitely
thing.
Sway
there
in
was
your
an
seat.
Intermission in the middle of the show.
Yeah.
And then at the rest of the show, the second half, that couple was sitting. They had felt the pressure so much that they sat. And here's what I'm going to say. They had standing capital that they wasted at the beginning of the show that they didn't have
at the end of the show. They did not play
They did
it
not
right.
play their cards right.
Well, I'm glad we got to discuss that really important topic. It's the politics of concert going. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the politics of gerrymandering, which seems to be getting out of control all across the country. We want your thoughts. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back on Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. It's not like there's a line between the good people and the bad people. It's not like you're one or the other. That line, about lines, comes from the movie Lone Star, set in, of course, Texas. And moral ambiguity seems to be the prevailing mood right now in politics. Urged on by President Trump, Texas Republicans want to take a rare step, redrawing congressional lines well after the census to swing as many as 5 House seats in their direction. To prevent that from happening, Texas Democrats fled the state. Each side now accuses the other of not playing fair. Meanwhile, Democrats across the country are responding to the Texas gambit with vows to further gerrymander their own states, tit for tat. Today, we're going to discuss why this is happening, what political leaders should do in this fraught moment, and the implications for our country. Our guests are David Daly, a senior fellow at FairVote and the author of the book Rat Bleeped, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. David, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And I hope you don't mind me lightly editing the name of your book. We also have with us John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. John, great to have you.
Thanks for having me too.
And our question for you, the listener, should political leaders abandon good government reforms and go all in on gerrymandering? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, great to see you. Drop your comments in the chat. John, I want to start with you. A lot of people are probably confused simply by the fact that Texas can do this, that they can just redraw the lines. So in a state like Texas, can you redraw the lines whenever you want?
You absolutely can. We have a long history, really going back even to the 1790s when our parties were emerging, of states being controlled by one party and trying to draw the lines or change the electoral system to affect the outcome of the next election. Now, we do have, sometimes states have their own restrictions, which are either easier or harder to get around. And we do have sometimes court versus legislative initiated redistrictings or mid-decade redistrictings, which, you know, have been very common. So I it's not something that hasn't happened before. We're used to the regular decade redistricting. But we've had many, many redistrictings in various states across, especially in the last 20, 30 years. It's become more common again.
So, David, the fact that Texas doesn't do this every year or every month is simply Texas's discretion. So they could have been doing this all along regularly, but it's just there's some sort of, I guess, etiquette or courtesy that has prevented it from happening before. Explain that to me, David Daly.
Yeah, it's a good point. The trouble with gerrymandering, right, is politicians ordinarily believe that they can only get away with it once a decade instead of every 2 or 4 years. And so the custom has been to draw these lines every 10 years. You know, a mid-decade redraws for specific partisan purposes, I think, are a little bit rarer, especially recently. Texas certainly gave it a go back in 2003. Georgia made an attempt a few years back and they abandoned that. Certainly sometimes states have been forced to do a redraw if a court has stepped in and said your previous map was unfair under certain a state constitutional or Voting Rights Act prescriptions. I think those circumstances are a little bit different because you're heading
Sure.
usually in the direction of fairness at those points in time. And now what we are seeing in blue states and red states is a drive towards maximizing every possible seat you can. It's an all-out power grab.
Yeah,
And
so
maybe I can note,
go ahead, John.
there's one reason that I think it doesn't happen quite as often as it might, is that often the same party is in control at the beginning of the decade and continues to be in control. When we saw in 2000, in the early 2000s, when Texas and Georgia to some extent changed, that was because there had been a long time shift away from Democrats being in power to Republicans now for having their first majority. We don't have that in this case, but I think two things we do have in Texas. One, the president is obviously asking for help from the states because he's worried about a narrow majority in the House losing in a midterm election. But also, the Republicans have done incredibly well in the last couple of elections, especially in the last presidential election, especially among Hispanic voters, generally increasing their margins in Texas. And they think they might just be in a different position now where they can draw safer seats. Sometimes that backfires on you,
Yep.
but it is the case that they see themselves as in a different place, even though they were in the majority at the beginning of the district. They now have a more secure state, they believe, and ability to draw districts more favorable to
Yeah, so
themselves.
historically you're constrained by two things. One, potential political blowback for messing with the lines. The other is that once you've gerrymandered, there isn't often that much more to gerrymander. But Texas seems to be an exception at this particular moment. You did mention, though, John, the possibility that this backfires. So, what does the backfire scenario look like for the Texas GOP? Basically, they draw a map that dilutes the vote a little bit too much, and then they lose a seat that they thought was safe. Is that how it works, John?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of ways. The main way is, especially if you're looking ahead at a whole decade or several election cycles, that maybe you have a good sense of where you are now, but then a wave
Stuff
of
changes.
election comes in the other elections, and then all of a sudden these moderately safe people you created on your own side are unsafe, and then they lose those elections. But the other factor I would note that often makes it difficult, and I think you're seeing that in some of the discourse over some of the states, is that the individual incumbents, even Republican members of the Texas legislature or Maryland members of the Democratic Congress, like their districts. They don't necessarily want to change. They don't want to change just for the sake of helping the party eke out a few more seats. And it might affect whether they get primaried or whether they're safe or even just whether they know their voters. And so it's not always so simple to say, hey, the party can maximize its votes. It has to deal with its own membership sometimes in ways that can backfire on
Yeah,
you.
this is a fraught issue even within the back rooms of the parties. I want to play this clip now as we transition into talking about how Democrats could or should or may respond to whatever's going on in Texas. This is Beto O'Rourke, who has unsuccessfully run for office in Texas, but is a leading Democratic figure there, talking about how other states should respond to what Texas is doing. Some fiery language here, a little warning for you. Here's Beto O'Rourke.
This doesn't just affect the people of Texas. It affects every single one of the 330 million Americans wherever we live. So states that have the power to do so, that are led by Democrats right now, must also redistrict to add Democratic advantage in California, where we can pick up some seats. And I know that there are some of you old line, old school Democrats, and I used to be one of them, who are like, hey, wait a second. This isn't right. This isn't how it's supposed to work. How it's supposed to work. We need to win political power in this country right now. We got to fight back. We got to fight fire with fire. We actually have to win political power.
And Marcia emails us with much the same sentiment, although fewer curse words. Marcia says, I believe, as several Texas Dems, along with others, have stated, that we must fight fire with fire. Our days of going high do not seem to have been either effective or appreciated. We must do what we can to counter Texas gerrymandering. If we do nothing, we will lose all opportunity for representation in government, provided we still have one. Okay, David Daley, does Marcia have a point? Is it time for Democrats to get down into the mud with the Texas Republicans and strike back? A, how might they do that? And B, what will be the end game of that?
I would suggest you don't fight fire with fire. I think you fight fire with water. And
That is the typical way, yes.
And so I think that I understand the impetus on the Democratic side to try to strike back here and to retaliate for what is happening in Texas. The margin of power in this country is very close. It's a 3-seat margin in the U.S. House. We're heading into a midterm election that is extraordinarily consequential, and both sides certainly feel that way. I would suggest that Democrats simply are on the losing side of the math here,
Let's
that
break that
they
down.
can
I want to
do.
get into the math here because it's
Yeah,
extremely complicated.
I think
Each
the
state has
Democrats
its
can
own
fight.
rules.
Democrats can choose to fight fire with fire here. They can bring a gun to a gunfight or use any of the metaphors that some of the Democratic governors are talking about these days. The trouble is they're out of ammo and targets. It's not as if Democrats haven't done any gerrymandering this decade. They did a pretty good job in the states that they controlled. Their political problem is that they controlled fewer of them. And part of this is that Republicans did a better job of gerrymandering a decade earlier and still hold advantages in some of those states. But Democrats pushed their edge in Maryland. They've got a 7-1 map there. They pushed their edge in Illinois. They have a 14-3 map there. They grabbed seats in Oregon, in Nevada, in New Mexico. There's not a whole lot left out there. There's California, and I'm sure we can get into California, but that's about 4 seats. You could probably push a 43-9 map there to 47-5, 48-4, something in that ballpark before it starts to backfire on you. Republicans are not going to stop in Texas. You are going to have a new map in Ohio. The current map is only a 4-year map. You're already hearing that Missouri and Florida are going to take a look at this. Vice President Vance is in Indiana today talking to the governor there. Republicans, if they wanted to continue, could look at New
So
Hampshire, they could look at Kentucky.
from a purely strategic perspective, though, David, is the Democratic response here basically take the loss in Texas and don't escalate the conflict? Because a loss seems to be coming in Texas at some point. We don't have to get into the whole leaving the state thing and what Abbott is doing in response there, but it seems like at some point this will likely happen. So strategically, just talking strategically, not morally or ethically, is the move for Democrats here just take your loss in Texas?
It might be, I mean, Democrats could go forward in California, but I think if they do, they are going to see that they are going to be drowned by mid-decade redistricting in other states that they simply can't counteract. They can't counteract it in New York until 2028. The numbers here simply do not add up for Democrats. I know that's an unsatisfactory answer to many Democrats out there who want to see their party fight back. What we need here is a national standard. What we need is the water that a national standard would provide. We don't have that for a lot of reasons, and I'm sure we'll get into some. The Supreme Court decision in 2019 that closed the federal courts to partisan gerrymandering cases, the inability of Democrats to work through a national ban on partisan gerrymandering when they had a trifecta control. Part of that is the filibuster, but part of that is their own fault for not breaking it off and having it be a separate bill. There's a lot of reasons why we are in this place. And I think that what we're seeing as this turns into a national firefight is that, state by state is what the solution here has to be a national one for everybody.
Well, I'm going to get into some potential solutions later and also some of the constraints on the federal courts. But first, let me bring in a caller. This is Chris from Newark, Delaware, on the line. Hey, Chris, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out the irony that the census, the reason that you had redistricting every 10 years was that's the only time the data were available after each census. And then for the 1990 census, the Census Bureau moved to block level what became GIS computer mapping, which then became very easy to gerrymander. And I did some of that in the 90s. And then survey data is now routinely available almost every year, the American Community Survey. But the original intent back in 1980 in the computer mapping was to enforce the Voting Rights Act and to provide data.
So a reform effort that you think has sort of backfired in a way, Chris.
Yeah. It's just completely flipped over.
Well, I actually want to get into that idea. Thanks for that call, Chris, about reform efforts backfiring, because one of the ironies in all this is that there were redistricting reforms in some of these Republican states that are now considering further gerrymandering. So I believe Florida and Ohio. And yet it seems like the reforms just haven't held up to the political pressure against them in those states. I mean, John, can you navigate us through this? It seems like even in the states that are going forward with more gerrymandering, there are things, there are laws on the books approved by the voters to try to stop this exact thing. Why isn't it working?
Well, there are a whole bunch of different measures one could think about to make gerrymandering less political. I guess I would say that, you know, it's hard to agree on criteria. It's hard to know how to enforce those criteria. We have other things that we think are good about the voting system, the Voting Rights Act. We have considerations there. Those might be partly for the Voting Rights Act, but also might play into the politics of a state. So I do think it's, you know, it's not so easy. It's not so easy to imagine a national conversation where we come to some agreement. There are a number of states with commissions, but you see even in California, we didn't really mention this as much, but California has drawn a map which maybe not intentionally, but is definitely proportionally much more favorable to Democrats than the statewide proportion that Republicans won in the state. And so Republicans, I think, are a little skeptical of some of these criteria. So I think getting agreement is very difficult. It's difficult enough in a state. And it may be more difficult, I think, for Californian Democrats to override their commission. That might not work, but it is still there. And they, too, are thinking about sort of finding ways around it. So I just think this is a worthwhile conversation to have. But if you're going to have it at the national level so that every state has to do the same thing, boy, it's going to be a little bit of a long slog here when we want to agree between the parties as to the criteria you'd want to put on nonpartisan redistricting. Yeah.
David, Florida and Ohio did was, I would say what happened in Florida and Ohio is that Republicans steamrolled and ignored constitutional language that huge majorities of voters passed. In 2010 in Florida, what you saw was that 62% of voters passed a fair districts amendment to the state constitution for that, you know, banned redistricting that benefited or disadvantaged either side. And almost immediately after that, what you saw in Florida was that Republicans devised a sneaky scam way around it. They smuggled a partisan consultant-driven maps into the system, and all of this is documented in a court case that the state Supreme Court in 2015 upended about 8 or 9 of those seats and forced a mid-decade redraw toward fairness. And what happened in 2021, the Republican response to this was to gerrymander further, but to take over the state Supreme Court in such a way that the new judges would allow that. So you have a much more gerrymandered map in Florida now than you had previously, but you've got a different state Supreme Court that will not uphold the, you know, what 62% of Floridians, Democrats,
well,
Republicans.
Well, let me ask you then, David, on that point, though, because you said in this particular moment, you don't think Democrats should fight fire with fire because they don't have the firepower to do it. The broader question is whether they should copy those tactics in Florida that you laid out. So you can pack a state Supreme Court to get a favorable ruling about some past amendment to the Constitution. There's all sorts of ways you can go about this. I think that's maybe the bigger question for Democrats here is, do you go a little deeper into the system to create the groundwork so that you can essentially gerrymander everywhere? How do you contend with that, David Daley?
I think what Republicans understood is that there's multiple layers and levers of power in this country, and that much of it starts with state legislatures, and that the other key piece are state Supreme Courts. And Republicans were faster and smarter and savvier to understand this, and they've got a huge head start, not only in red states, but in a lot of the purple states. I mean, their answer to the Obama election in 2008, at which point in time, you know, many Democratic and Republican analysts looked at this and said, well, the demographics, the generational change happening here, Republicans could be a minority party for some time to come. And what Republicans recognized was that 2010 was a census year, and we redistrict after the census, and that if they were able to have a strategy, and this one was called Red Map, the Redistricting Majority Project, that focused on taking over swing state legislatures and solidifying control of state legislatures, that they would be able to draw the lines in 2011 in Pennsylvania, where you lived through this, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, Florida, Indiana, Alabama. This was an effort to take all of these legislatures in 2010, and it worked. Republicans laid this out. I mean, Karl Rove has an op-ed, you know, in the Wall Street Journal, March of 2010, that says exactly what they're going to do and where they're going to do it and what the consequences are. And Democrats completely fell asleep.
So should Democrats do that?
Democrats
raise the question.
Need to rebuild that infrastructure. Democrats have to understand how power is built. It's not built at the White House every 4 years. It's built from the ground up in communities around the country and on courts.
Let me bring in a caller before we get to break. This is Ed from South Jersey. By the way, our question today, should political leaders abandon good government reforms and go all in on gerrymandering? Ed from South Jersey, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is based on the fact that I teach a course on the Constitution. My view is that gerrymandering is way down on the list of the reforms needed. We ought to start with getting rid of the Electoral College and then build up from there.
Okay, interesting. And some people are also bringing up that similar thoughts. Mike from Newark, Delaware, wants to talk about how we apportion districts and how today, for instance, you know, all of Delaware is represented by one person, right? You could go into the direction of multi-representational districts. I don't know how far we want to go down that path this hour, but I guess I'll put that to you, John Fortier, before we get to break here in a couple minutes. A lot of focus today on how we draw the lines. There are other ways to potentially make things more fair. Do you think there should be focus on those over the question of how lines are drawn?
Well, I guess I think the question of how lines are drawn is going to be an issue, and whatever we do on that doesn't necessarily preclude us from looking at other areas. So sure. I do think that there are other areas to look at, but you know, one thing that this discussion has illuminated is that we still are a very state-based system, just like the way we run elections in very different ways in 50 states. We have different rules about, even sometimes about the way the electors, the Electoral College are apportioned. So, you know, I think that one has to recognize that we are a state system and that there's kind of a competitive red and blue state arms race and sometimes in these wars. And maybe in some cases you can find a national consensus, but it's very hard. So I do think other areas make sense to look at, but I think that the state level is the primary place where we're going to be looking at these reforms.
Kelly writes us, I can't be the only one who is sick and tired of politicians being so self-serving and power-hungry that they completely disregard the fact that what they're actually screwing with is their constituents' representation. It's a shameful state of affairs right now. Repeating our question this hour, should political leaders abandon good government reforms and go all in on gerrymandering? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat. We're talking with David Daley, senior fellow at FairVote, author of the national bestseller Rat Bleeped, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. We're also talking with John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Keep those calls and questions coming. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. We are talking about the GOP effort in Texas to redraw congressional district lines mid-cycle and how it may have ignited a redistricting arms race, with Democratic governors now threatening to gerrymander their state's congressional maps. Walking us through what this fight will mean for the midterms and our democracy are David Daly, a senior fellow at FairVote and the author of the book Rat Bleeped, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. If you're listening at home, join the conversation. Should political leaders abandon good government reforms and go all in on gerrymandering? Call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat. Fiona emails us and says, in Australia, voting is mandatory. Every person has to vote, no exceptions. This decreases the influence of gerrymandering, and you cannot change districts without state approval. So telling us to look to Australia. I also want to bring in a caller now. This is Ruth from Warminster on the line, who I think has an idea for a reform here. Ruth, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is we have to register as Republican, Democrat, or Independent. Why not eliminate party affiliation and draw districts according to the number of people needed in each district?
Thank you for that call, Ruth. So on the prospect of reform, John Fortier, what incentive structure would create the pathway for reform, whether you're talking about different types of primaries, whether you're talking about ranked choice voting, whether you're talking about redistricting? It's hard to imagine a world where politicians are incentivized to embrace or at least open themselves up to that reform. So what's the roadmap for reform that allows self-serving politicians to get on board?
Well, I think the roadmap can vary. In a number of states, you've often had through the ballot question, putting the question to the people, do you want a redistricting commission, for example? And some of these commissions have been passed that way. Maybe that doesn't always work for all time. Maybe, as we see in California, maybe there'll be some reconsideration of whether that's a good idea for the long time. The other thing to think about is occasionally there is both parties coming together for some sort of reform. Now, people don't always love that. Often they accuse both parties of doing a kind of incumbent protection plan. They have a bipartisan commission where the best thing is to really just make sure that both parties are taken care of. But that's a kind of reform as well. So look, I think it is mostly through the states. Technically, in terms of House redistricting, we could pass a federal law and supersede state law. But that's very difficult to imagine what the deal would look like. So I think in states, you really have some combination of, you know, trying to get the parties to agree on something, or perhaps going around the legislature and going to the people at the ballot. And that has worked at least to some degree for some of these reforms.
David Daly, you've brought up this idea of a federal law or a federal standard. A, what should it look like? And B, we actually haven't gotten to this yet. We should. And maybe answer this part first. What power do the courts have at this moment in time? Seems like they gave away some power in 2019 with a big decision. Mm-hmm. What can the federal courts do to strike down a map? And then what type of federal law would be needed to give the courts the power that they need in the future to even this playing field?
I think that's a really big piece of the problem is, I think, as John identified, right? And you've alluded to as well, that, you know, politicians don't always have the self-interest to solve this themselves. It is really difficult to imagine Congress deciding that it is going to change the way that these members themselves were elected and hold power. It's why the ballot initiative has been so successful in the states that allow that. What the courts did in 2019, when John Roberts in a 5-4 decision effectively closed the federal courts to partisan gerrymandering claims, I think is a real reason why we are in this unfortunate place today, because that decision came at a time when federal judges around the country, appointed by Democratic and Republican presidents alike, looked at extreme gerrymanders drawn by Democrats in Maryland, by Republicans in Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and North Carolina, and said, we have all the tools we need to decide when these gerrymanders have gone too far. There's all kinds of different evidence we can evaluate, the statistical tools, the computer models, the, you know, eyewitness testimony. We can treat this like any other trial, and we can show when this has gone too far. Mm-hmm. And the court said no. The Supreme Court said this is a political issue. The federal courts are going to stay out of it. And what I fear happened there is that it incentivized and enabled the kind of far-reaching gerrymanders we saw both parties enact in 2021, knowing that nobody would stop them in the more neutral federal courts, and that the only place that these things could be stopped would be in state courts, which increasingly in blue states and in red states are themselves partisan bodies.
So what type of law theoretically could give the federal courts the power to step in? It's obviously, well, the courts don't think the Constitution has the meat to do that. So there has to be some sort of new federal law, right?
I think what we ought to look towards is a more proportional house. I think the answer really lies in multi-member districts and ranked choice voting in every state. And if you could do this, I mean, I'm calling from Massachusetts, where we have a 9-0 Democratic delegation. President Trump mentioned this very angrily yesterday, and he's right. You know, there's plenty of Republicans here in Massachusetts. They haven't had any representation here since 1994. That's a long time. There's just as many Democrats in Tennessee and Missouri that, you know, lack real representation. Mm-hmm. And if you were to be able to draw larger multi-member districts, elect proportionately from there, you would, I think, take away the importance of these lines. You could drain the power out of those lines. You would elect more representative delegations from every state. You might see New England Republicans again. You might see Southern Democrats. You might see various independents. And those are the kind of people that, when Congress worked and functioned better, were able to talk to one another and get things done. Yeah. So I think that's really...
On that point, I just want to first read in an email, but then ask a question to John off of what you just said, David. This is an email from Bernice, who says, many years ago, late 80s, perhaps, I was living in Abington Township, went to the polls, all set to vote for a specific candidate. Surprise, he wasn't on the ballot. Unbeknownst to me, somebody had drawn a thin, squiggly finger joining our house to Bucks County. Abington Township's in a different county. It's in Montgomery County. And so, obviously, people feel alienated by this. And I think the question is how this is impacting our democracy and how our chambers of Congress function. Do you think there's been a big impact, John? Because David talked about this idea. There used to be these moderate Republicans and there were these Southern Democrats. It was sort of a complicated spectrum. Do you think gerrymandering specifically is the reason we are not in that place today, or is it lower down the list, John?
Yeah, I think you're right about the way in which our major parties have changed, although I think redistricting and gerrymandering was not the major factor. I think it's a small factor in what people call polarization, but I think it's not the major factor. I also note, and I don't necessarily think people think this is the greatest thing, but while many states are out of whack proportionally to their statewide vote or presidential vote in terms of their House membership, the House as a whole is roughly what we would expect it to be. Actually, I'd say Republicans are probably slightly underrepresented in this last Congress because of the war of the states and some Republican states overrepresenting Republicans and some Democratic states overrepresenting Democrats. So I don't think, you know, we face some structural mismatch between, you know, the national vote and what the national legislature looks like. And then I guess I just come back to the last point is I do think, you know, it's an interesting concept to think of that we would come to some agreement about what are unfair districts or what are gerrymandered districts. And there are all sorts of standards. But I think coming to agreement on that or coming to agreement on which body should decide that, that's something I think if you could get a bunch of Republicans and Democrats in a room and agree to that, that would be great.
Yeah.
But I think that's something that we're not really close to. And that's really the heart of this issue. If you can't get that, then it's hard to set up a system where somebody says, okay, well, these are fair districts and these are not.
Yeah, you know, we've described this as an arms race. And sometimes arms races stall out. There are sort of detentes, there are agreements, and people reset. I don't know if that's coming with this particular arms race, but it is always possible. John brings up an important point, though, David. Here's some stats. The GOP won 51.3% of the two-party vote in 2024 and 50.5% of U.S. House seats. That sounds about right. And I think the point that John was making is that basically everyone is gerrymandered so much that it's all a wash at this point. There really isn't that big of an impact. David, how would you respond?
I'd suggest that's not quite it. most of the actual political science studies suggest that Republicans gained about a 16-seat advantage in this last cycle due to redistricting. Democrats are certainly overextended on this map, I think because they won a higher percentage of the handful of seats that are still close in the country. There's 37 districts out of 435, not a very good number, that remain within 5%. And Democrats managed to win 22 of those in the last election. So I'd say that Democrats are a little overextended on this map. But the national balance comes from this massive gerrymandering every place, right? If Democrats put the national map back into a little bit of a closer focus in this last round than it was the decade before, it was by gerrymandering themselves and all these other states. And Illinois Republicans shouldn't have to pay for what Democrats in Maryland do, and the other way around. And this is bad for representation. It's bad to set up 398 of 435 districts and that are so uncompetitive that the only race that matters is a low turnout party primary that can, you know, very few people participate in. This is a dangerous situation, and any balance that did exist in the map heading into 2024, I would suggest, is about to be blown apart.
John, let me bounce that back to you now, because it's one thing to say that there's roughly as many GOP representatives as there were people that voted for the GOP proportionally in the Congress. It's another thing to look at who those GOP members are, and on the other side, who those Democratic members are, and what races matter most to them, and what they are motivated by. And I do think there's a sense that they're motivated mostly by fear of being primary. They're really looking at their primary election and not as much in their general, in part because of the way district lines are drawn. Do you think this impacts the types of candidates or the positions that candidates take, John?
I guess I'm of the view that it might have a small effect, but there are larger issues at play here. And I think the parties, you're right, you mentioned earlier, have realigned. We had a system for many years where the Democratic Party had a very strong conservative wing and then a progressive wing, and Republicans had a little bit of the reverse, which meant there are more people in the middle. But, you know, that realignment is something that was really deeply baked into our system. It came out of the Civil War and how the South, which party the South was going to be aligned with, and the changes over time. Those are much bigger questions than how we draw the district. So while I think it's important, I think this issue of our parties being polarized left and right really comes from other things and not this.
Yeah, I want to bounce that now back to you, David, because I do wonder, what's the magnitude of the effect? A lot of this stuff sounds bad, and I think most people would agree that it has some effect. But, you know, there's a lot of moving parts here. It's hard to isolate how much, gerrymandering specifically, or just voting rules in general, are responsible for our politics today. What's your take on that, David Daley?
Certainly, there's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of things affecting all of this. But I would suggest that this is one of the most important. This is how we choose the member who is supposed to elect us, represent us most closely, right? I mean, John Adams talked about a house as a replica of the people in miniature. And we don't come close to that because of the way we draw these lines. We have 398 of these districts in which the only race that matters is a partisan primary. Different people get elected out of partisan primaries. I've seen it happen here in Massachusetts, right? Because the Democratic primary is the only race that matters. So you have 11 or 12 people jump into that race. Somebody can win with 21, 22% and then coast into office. They are only being elected by a fraction of the district. And then they're only accountable to a fraction of the district. And when you have nearly 400 members who are behaving that way with those political incentives, we really need to change those incentives if we want to have a Congress that is working on behalf of people. Yeah. People feel like the system is broken, that the representatives don't care about what they think, and they're right because they don't have to.
We have only about a minute left, but John, even if you don't think that this is the primary cause, that gerrymandering is the one of the primary drivers of partisanship in our politics, Do you think the way that this conversation is unfolding in Texas is a symptom or is a points to what's changed in our politics? And I say specifically the fact that no one in this conversation is even pretending this is about anything other than power, seizing power, and maintaining power. I feel like 20 years ago, maybe they at least tried to brush around with a little gray area in there. I don't know if that was better. But do you think the way this is playing out real quickly in 15 seconds is at least symptomatic of a problem here?
Well, I do think our system is set up for this to be deeply political in the states. The states are going to reflect their own majorities and try to help themselves out in the electoral process. I hope that there are some ways in which around the edges, maybe in a national conversation or in some state conversations, we could find some ways to mitigate this. Yeah. But I'm not big on a large reform wiping this all away.
That's John Fortier, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. John, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And David Daly, Senior Fellow at FairVote and author of the book Rat Bleeped, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. David, thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2. Enjoyed the conversation.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. With this note at the end of the program from our producer, Paige Marie Bessler, 60th anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act is today. History echoing on this Wednesday in the Delaware Valley. We'll talk to you tomorrow.